Well, if you want our proof that the legacy of Stalinism still haunts the left, you need go no further than the debates that emerged with the outbreak of the revolution in Libya earlier this year. While a clear majority of left-wing organisations and groups voiced support for the Libyan uprising, a number either explicitly backed Gaddafi or surreptitiously undermined the revolution and attempted to depict it as simply a reactionary movement in alliance with US imperialism. At the head of those offering solidarity to Gaddafi's tottering rule were the populist left leaders of Latin America. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, as WikiLeaks confirmed in some detail this February, was a long-term ally of the Libyan dictator. At a 2009 summit in Venezuela, Chavez and Gaddafi congratulated each other on their revolutions during their ceremonies, and Chavez declared what Simón Bolívar is to the Venezuelan people, Gaddafi is to the Libyan people. So little wonder then that Chavez refused to denounce the massacres being carried out by Gaddafi's regime against the uprising. In a televised speech, Chavez told his audience, a campaign of lies is being spun together regarding Libya. I'm not going to condemn him, Gaddafi. I'd be a coward to condemn someone who has been my friend. Well, it's actually half true. Fidel Castro, in a widely circulated statement, expressed quite similar sentiments. Both Chavez and Castro warned that the main danger facing Libya was Western intervention, an argument that was to be taken up by a number of groups and individuals on the left seeking to undermine the revolution. Now, you know, socialists, of course, have to completely oppose the imperialist intervention in Libya that has since taken place, which is aimed entirely at defeating the democratic revolution and ensuring the continued subjugation of the Arab people. But the campaign waged by Chavez, Castro, others on the left like MR Zine, the online journal, they used the imperialist intervention simply as a justification, in my view, for their refusal to break politically with Gaddafi. Even of those on the left who supported the Libyan revolt, a number have been hampered by their shady past of support for and collaboration with Gaddafi's dictatorship. The Australian Socialist Alliance, to their credit, have backed the revolution in Libya. But in the past, they, like many others on the left internationally, championed Gaddafi as a heroic anti-imperialist and even at times almost describing him as a socialist. On returning from the Asia-Pacific Solidarity Conference held in Libya in 1987, and there's heaps of these conferences that people from all around the left internationally went to in Libya, Peter Boyle, who is now a central leader of the Socialist Alliance, wrote what was, an absolutely sycophantic, in my view, disgraceful piece for Direct Action, which was then the party paper, praising to high heaven the achievements of Gaddafi's regime and the Libyan revolution. According to Boyle, Libya was a country of prosperous egalitarianism in which most Libyans I spoke to insisted they felt more free in their country than in any other they had visited. Now, I could go on, quoting that article. It was a long article about, two or three page article, and I won't actually do that. If people want more quotes from it, they can have a look in the article in the journal. But, according to Boyle, Libya, much more democratic than the West, and so on. Now, Socialist Alliance members have, I wrote an article about this for our website. Socialist Alliance members have claimed in response that it's, the height of sectarian quibbling to raise this historical record of their predecessor organisation's support for Gaddafi. And I think they're very much wrong in raising these objections. First of all, the support given by them and others on the left internationally to despotic regimes now and in the past undermines the left's claim that socialism is about human liberation, not about despotism. It gives ammunition to the right to help them bury the truth about what's really going on in the Middle East, i.e. the West's responsibility for the tyrannical power structures of that region, to bury that under a sea of accusations against the left. But more than that, I think the fact that at various points so many of the left have looked positively at Gaddafi's regime, particularly in the past, indicates that there's something very wrong with how many people on the left conceive of what socialism is all about. And I think to understand this, we have to go back and have a look at the impact politically, ideologically, that Stalinism's had on the left over the last century, I suppose. Because the idea the identification of Stalin's Russia and the states that followed it with socialism really was one of the great tragedies of the 20th century. Stalinism had nothing to do with human liberation and nothing at all to do with Marxism. His brutal one-party dictatorship represented not the continuation of the October Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, but the annihilation and the defeat of that revolution. And in fact, you know, to consolidate power, Stalin had to physically exterminate every last aspect of you know, the revolutionary movement and the revolutionary leadership of 1917. Now, people say today that the Russian Revolution was a long time ago, which, of course, is undeniably true. But the association of Stalinism with Marxism, I think, is still at the centre of the critique of Marxism, not simply from openly pro-capitalists, but also from anarchists and libertarians and so on. And I think it's impossible to answer the arguments about the supposedly authoritarian nature of socialism unless you're crystal clear that Stalinism was not just some, you know, imperfect model of socialism, but fundamentally had nothing to do with genuine socialism and Marxism. And I think groups like, you know, those who put out Green Left Weekly are incapable of doing this, given their history of glossing over the true nature of Stalinism and comparing it favourably with the West. The Socialist Alliance's forerunner organisation, the Socialist Workers' Party, which later became the DSP, the Democratic Socialist Party, was describing Russia as being socialist in their paper as late as 1987. Now, over the course of the 50s and the 60s, and particularly the 70s, the official communist parties, the Stalinist parties, increasingly actually distanced themselves from the USSR, you know, moving to Euro-communism and various other things. But the SWP in Australia, despite its origins in Trotskyism, became even more enamoured with the Soviet Union as it slowly creeped towards collapse. Renfrew Clark, reporting back from DSP member, reporting back from SWP, sorry, reporting back from a 1986 trip to Moscow for the party's paper Direct Action, gave an account of his experience, which really was, you know, reminiscent of the rosy reports that were given in the 1930s by the, you know, the journalists toured through the USSR by Stalin's, you know, Department for Useful Idiots. He wrote of his experience, for an instant, it seems you've identified the essential difference between the USSR and the United States. The Soviet Union is a society not at war with itself. It's not paradise, but it is remarkably free from the rage and despair never all that distant in present-day America. That Soviet society works is something that even hardened enemies of socialism are now being forced to admit. Now, according to Clark, revolution was not only unnecessary in the USSR, it was highly unlikely, given the esteem with which Soviet citizens regarded their government. He wrote, "The Soviet dissident movement, even if given totally free rein, would have enormous difficulty mustering the support of even 10% of the population against the current Communist Party leadership. The great majority of Soviet citizens are firm supporters of socialism and of the party. The advantages of socialism are regarded as having been proven in practice, and the party as having earned the right to continue to lead the people forward. The creation of a thoroughly humane and liberated society in the USSR will require further daring economic, social and political reforms, but it will not require the fundamental traumatic remaking of class relations that is an essential in the West. The Soviet workers and peasants have already made their revolution." Now, this was written just 3 years before the Berlin Wall fell. And yet, you know, Socialist Alliance members today have the gall to be outraged when we dare to associate their politics with Stalinism. Okay, so Stalinist influence not only led the left to identify socialism with authoritarianism, you know, centralised dictatorships with statised economies, it also transformed the left's understanding of class struggle, political power, and the strategies and tactics of revolution. So from the mid-1920s onwards, a key part of Stalin's consolidation of power involved transforming Marxism from a weapon of revolutionary change into an ideological structure that would legitimise Stalin's counter-revolution in Russia and justify Russian policy internationally. And the first of these revisions was the famous doctrine of socialism in one country, which was announced in 1924. socialism in one country was the definitive self-justification of the Stalinist bureaucracy. Renouncing the international revolution was not just a demonstration, I suppose, a declaration of peace with world capitalism. It was also a statement that the current state of affairs in Russia was not going to be some temporary phenomenon. The thesis of Marx and of Lenin that development towards socialism would mean the withering away of the state was replaced by a socialism in which the state apparatus would grow ever stronger. And the idea that one or more socialist states could exist with relative stability in a world still dominated by capitalism also laid the basis for reconceptualizing socialism, not as a global struggle against class rule, but simply one among many models on which a national economy could be built. So once the dimension of international revolution was taken out, socialist countries and capitalist countries could peacefully coexist, as the term later became. Now, of course, in practice, you know, especially during the Cold War era, there was conflict between the socialist countries, so-called, and the West, both open and by proxy. But really, this wasn't fundamentally different to the conflicts between states that are inherent to world capitalism in the era of imperialism. You know, conflicts that could be managed by a mixture of military and economic struggle, and also by diplomacy. The notion that a state could be defined as socialist, based on which countries it aligned itself to, or whether it had a statized economy, also meant that all of a sudden a dizzying array of countries could become socialist, and in many cases become socialist and then revert back to capitalism quite quickly, without any deep-seated class struggle at all, let alone a social revolution. So the Committee for Workers International, which today people in Australia is the Socialist Party, aligned to them, at one time considered that alongside the traditional Stalinist states like China, the USSR, Vietnam and Cuba, that they all said were workers' states, you could add to the list Laos, Kampuchea, Burma, Syria, Angola, Mozambique, Aden, Benin and Ethiopia, all in, you know, all as being workers' states of one kind or another. And, yeah, then they could stop being workers' states next week. Okay, so that's socialism in one country. Stalin's second major break with Marxism on the level of theory was to discard the idea that the working class had to maintain its independence from other social classes and fight for its own interests, what was to become known as the Stalinist policy of the Popular Front. Now, the first disastrous manifestation of this turn, which has become the model for the treacherous role played by Stalinism later in the century in the colonial world, was the Chinese Revolution of 1925 to 27. Where instead of building an independent workers' movement and communist party, Stalin forced the Chinese communists to subordinate themselves entirely to the bourgeois nationalist Kuomintang. And to try and keep the Kuomintang on side, the CCP had to actively restrain the workers' and peasants' rebellion that the Chinese bourgeoisie, emerging bourgeoisie, so feared. So, you know, submitting after, actually to their credit, considerable resistance, submitting to Stalinism, the CCP... The opposed peasant excesses, so-called. They promoted illusions in the Kuomintang and its leader, Chiang Kai-shek, and they forced the workers' movement to disarm, either burying their guns or handing them over to the Kuomintang. In April of 1927, the consequences of this policy became clear. A general strike by workers in Shanghai, which was called to greet the approaching Kuomintang army, was crushed brutally by Chiang Kai-shek. So Stalin's policy led the Chinese Revolution to a devastating defeat. And decades later, variants of this same policy you know, led to you know, crushing defeats and massacres of the left in countries like Iraq, Egypt, Syria, Lebanon and Iran. But the Chinese debacle did not, of course, dissuade Stalin, who was by then not the slightest bit interested in spreading revolution internationally. The communist parties by the 1930s existed purely to serve the interests of the new Stalinist ruling class in Russia. And so by the mid-30s, this meant trying to win support for Stalin's foreign policy from any possible quarter, and in particular from the ruling classes of the imperialist countries. And so this was, you know, this was what led to, they didn't call it the Popular Front in China, but this was when they moved into talking about the Popular Front, which went a step beyond the demand for unity with the Kuomintang in China. As the British socialist Duncan Hallis noted, He said it was no longer even a question of subordinating the working class of a semi-colonial country to a supposedly progressive national bourgeoisie in the alleged interests of the struggle against imperialism, which had been itself a subject, a policy rather, directly contrary to the decisions of the Comintern Second Congress. But it was now a matter of subordinating the working class and the national movements to the rulers of the two greatest colonial empires on earth, Britain and France. So after World War II, Stalinism evolved even further, away from any conception of working class self-emancipation. Immediately after the war, communist parties in countries like Germany and Italy entered bourgeois governments for the first time. And after 1947, with the onset of the Cold War, the communists once again became isolated from the political mainstream in the West, which they'd been integrated to in a number of countries during the war. But instead of turning back to class struggle rhetoric, as they had in the third period, they posed their arguments mostly in terms of the struggle against imperialism. In Asia, what this meant was armed guerrilla war in countries like Burma, Malaya, Indonesia, China, Vietnam, and the Philippines. In the West, there was a brief period after the war where they did, you know, push a much more class struggle sort of line. But at the same time as this, this went along the first stages of what became known as the peace movement, beginning with the International Conference of Intellectuals for Peace in 1948, which led to the formation of the World Peace Council in 1950. And this development was quite decisive in shifting the ideological outlook of the Communist International, the International Communist Movement, rather, away from class struggle and towards a class collaborationist or outright middle-class orientation. And the people involved they tried to orient to in the peace movement were very much intellectuals, the middle class, and so on. Now, after Stalin's death, this process continued to accelerate. In 1953, Russia announced that it had successfully manufactured a hydrogen bomb. So the first move away from orientation to workers' struggle as the means to advance Russian foreign policy in the West was when they implemented the Popular Front before the war. And then this new development, the getting the nuclear bomb, further reinforced this trend. As Ian Birchall put it, from now on, it was clear that the defence of Russia did not depend on the international communist movement. It depended on the Russian nuclear defence system keeping pace with the American. Now, quite paradoxically, really, the entry of the USSR into the nuclear race coincided with a renewed stress on the idea of peaceful coexistence. The acquisition of the bomb and the Popular Front policy had removed the working class from any agency in the struggle against world capitalism. And now, peaceful coexistence, the ideological child, I think, of socialism in one country, signalled that the Russian state had no interest in the radical transformation of the world order, but instead was concerned simply to maintain its place in that order. So class politics had given way completely to state diplomacy, and that diplomacy was directed at maintaining the status quo. And I think it's this latter factor there's a vital element in explaining the Sino-Soviet split and also the appeal of the new Maoist parties that emerged in the 1960s. Because whereas Russia had, since the Yalta Conference at the end of the war, succeeded in establishing itself as a great power, China was still underdeveloped and battling to improve its position in the imperialist pecking order. And this explains the much more assertive nature of Chinese foreign policy and rhetoric. But Maoism, based as it was on a nationalist state bourgeoisie that came to power without any involvement of working class forces, did not abandon any of the underlying politics of Stalinism. While more aggressively hostile towards the US, it rejected any orientation to working class struggle. Now, in the West, the communist parties increasingly moved away from being creatures of Russian foreign policy and became much more integrated into the institutions of their own national states. So through the 50s and 60s, as Russian influence waned, the CPs became much more similar to just the mainstream social democratic parties. And so the combination of all of these different developments reinforced the increasing disconnect between the idea of socialism and the working class. And this had significant implications for the way the left as a whole, going well beyond just the members of the actual communist parties, the way the left as a whole viewed its relationship to class. And if you go back prior to Marx, the concept of socialism had no particular single class identification. And it was really, you know, the whole ideological core of the battles that Marx waged throughout his lifetime was the attempt to transform socialism from a utopian ideology into the worldview and the theoretical tool of the working class. So as Hal Draper put it, historical materialism, or Marxism as conceived by Marx, was the theory and practice of the proletarian revolution. And Marx really succeeded, you know, in this aim of winning the argument about the relationship between the working class and socialism. In the period between the rise of the Second International, which based itself on Marx's principles, and, you know, from there up until the rise of Stalinism in the late 1920s, the idea of socialism was synonymous with the interests and the movement of one particular class, the working class. And, you know, this connection existed at a theoretical level, but it wasn't just at the level of theory. Prior to Stalinization, the leaders and the heroes of the Marxist movement were intimately connected with the working class struggle. So, you know, the icons of socialism in the period, you know, people like Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, James Connolly, Joe Hill, Eleanor Marx, Bill Haywood, you know, in Australia, figures like Tom Mann and Percy Brookfield, there's a talk about this weekend, you know, most of them union militants, as well as being, you know, the leaders of socialist organisations and, you know, working class leaders. There were, of course, intellectuals in this period, you know, people like Lenin, Engels, Luxembourg, Kautsky, Plekhanov, and so on. But they too were intimately connected to the workers' movement, and it was seen, you know, that for them to abandon the workers' movement was the same thing as abandoning socialism. But if you contrast that with the situation under Stalinism, actually the heroes of socialism were the leaders of states, guerrilla fighters in the hills, parliamentarians, and middle-class intellectuals. Socialism stopped being about class and became simply an ideological label. So you think the leading socialists in the public eye during the middle of the 20th century, aside from Stalin himself, you had Mao, Che Guevara, Castro, Ho Chi Minh, and so on. And even those, you know, and particularly the Western parties, who were actually leaders of working class parties or trade union leaders, for the most part, because of the reformist class collaborationist politics of Stalinism, they were increasingly distant from workers' concerns. You know, a little different from the middle class social democratic politicians who spent their time, you know, hobnobbing with the political establishment and only on rare occasions are condescending to maybe address a workers' rally or public meeting. One of the places that the ideology of Stalinism had the most debilitating impact is in the Arab world. And the underlying reason for this is that while in the West there was a pre-Stalinist socialist tradition, you know, remnants of which survived Stalinism in either the Trotskyist movement, amongst some syndicalists, amongst the left of social democracy and so on, this was virtually non-existent in the Arab world. And so it meant that Arab socialism was virtually from the outset Stalinist. And because of this, all the class collaborationist politics, the bureaucratic organisational practices and the opportunism that characterised Stalinism in the West was magnified in the Arab world. The Popular Front strategy that subordinated the interests of the working class and the peasantry to the supposedly progressive national bourgeoisie was absolutely hegemonic. In 1955, the leader of the Syrian Communist Party called on all enemies of feudalism, reaction and imperialism to join forces, and stated that the centre of our policy is to find meeting points, not disagreements, with all true nationalists. But there was no section, in truth, of the Arab bourgeoisie, even, you know, supposedly radical leaders at the time, like Gaddafi, who were prepared to actually mobilise the masses for any kind of determined fight against imperialism in the Middle East. In June 1969, Gaddafi opposed a popular war of liberation to free Palestine, arguing that the confrontation had to be between regular armies, you know, a confrontation that, of course, never took place. The Popular Front policy, you know, was an absolute disastrous dead end in the Middle East. It led to huge defeats from Iraq in 1958 to the Lebanese Civil War of the 1970s. But in spite of these failings, the Popular Frontist approach remained hegemonic on the left from, you know, the 1930s, really, up until today. The predominant idea on the left remains one of broad class alliances rather than class politics. And it wasn't just the official communist parties that adhered to this approach, but virtually all the other radical currents that emerged from the 1960s in the Arab world. Take just quickly the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. In 1969, PFLP leader George Habash attacked the party's rivals, the Democratic Front, as suffering from infantile leftism. He said, "We are not as against the Arab regimes as they are. We criticise, but collaborate with Arab regimes, as Mao did with the Kuomintang against the Japanese threat in China." So by tying themselves to, you know, various regimes over their history, the PFLP downplayed the need to build a mass revolutionary movement from below throughout the Arab world, and ended up providing a left cover for regimes like the Ba'ath in Iraq, which gave the PFLP substantial funding in the 1970s. And such diplomatic intrigue served to reinforce the tendency to replace the class struggle as the centrepiece of Marxism with the ideology of a classless anti-imperialism. So whereas for Lenin and the early Comintern, the anti-imperial struggle was an important element of the world struggle against capitalism, it was emphasised that this did not simply mean reducing the anti-capitalist struggle to opposition to imperialism. Lenin warned against giving the national liberation movements what he called a communist coloration. Yet by the 1960s, the line between anti-imperialist and socialist had become extremely fuzzy. And I think that's why you look at the left's attitude to Gaddafi. The new Arab left was not like the earlier communist parties in the sense of being rigidly, you know, going along with the latest dictate, the latest twist and turn of Russian foreign policy. You know, most of them weren't tied to the Russian state in that way. You know, their alliances with Russia or China or whoever else were much more pragmatic and open to change. But the ideological framework of Stalinism, class collaboration, substitutionism, and an orientation to the existing states, whether they were characterised as anti-imperialist or socialist or in many cases both, this continued to dominate the thinking of the broad left. Okay, so I turn to the West. By the 1950s and 60s, you know, Russia had started to lose a lot of its radical gloss. Its doctrine of peaceful coexistence, alongside the bloody suppression of the 1956 Hungarian uprising, Khrushchev's secret speech denouncing Stalin, made it much more, Russia, much less rather attractive to the new generation of young radicals that were beginning to emerge. But tragically, the political currents that arose to challenge official communism were still heavily impacted by Stalinism's distortion of Marxism. On the one hand, many on the new left, so-called, rejected the authoritarianism and the conservatism of the Stalinists by abandoning not only Leninism, but the whole conception of the working class as the key agent of social change. On the other hand, Maoism, with its militant rhetoric and militarist tactics and organisational methods, appeared as an alternative, a radical alternative vision of socialism. But in reality, it too was just another version of Stalinism. You know, the Maoists preached third worldism, that, you know, saw oppressed peoples or even, in some cases, oppressed nations as being just as important as the working class. They glorified guerrilla struggle and replaced the working class as the key agent of social change with an amorphous, you know, talk about the people, which is variously, you know, taken to mean the peasantry, you know, oppressed national groups, minorities, students, the urban poor, elements of the middle class, as well as industrial workers. And so this orientation meant that the left was defenceless when it faced, as it did, sustained repression from the ruling class. There was no current in the new left, and particularly thinking here about America, that was strong enough to argue for an orientation to organise workers as the way out of the abyss in the face of repression. For most students, you know, Maoism was the main model of serious politics on offer. So, you know, when they wanted to look, you know, politics was getting serious, that was the model that they looked to. And this was a dead end that in the United States led to the implosion of SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society, and eventuated in the absolute lunacy of the Weather Underground, which followed the logic of Maoism to its end point and tried to bring the third world guerrilla struggle to the US by planting bombs in the buildings of US corporations, which obviously didn't work. On the face of it, the Trotskyist currents at the time, that were considerable, stood on completely different ground to the third worldist Maoists. Their traditions claimed to go back not to Mao, but to, you know, Lenin, Trotsky, the first four congresses of the Comintern, and Trotsky's critique of Stalinism. Yet, in practice, the differences were not always that great. Writing about the revolutionary left in Europe at the time, British socialist Chris Harman wrote that what was common to both the soft Maoists and the would-be orthodox Trotskyists was substitutionism, the idea that some other force could substitute itself for the working class in the creation of socialism. While the movement was on the up in Italy or France or Spain or in Britain for that matter, this was not necessarily that apparent. Workers were in motion, and you had to be a fool not to relate to them. Although, as always, there are a fair number of fools. But when, from the mid-1970s onwards, the movement was checked, the substitutionism could easily lead revolutionaries to look to false gods, to the trade union bureaucracy, to liberal democracy, to armed lunacy, or even to changes in their own lifestyles. Okay, so, you know, official Stalinism in the 60s and 70s was still, you know, a big problem. You know, the huge communist parties, particularly in France, but in other countries like Italy as well, played a very crucial role in containing the revolutionary upsurge of class struggle that swept Europe in 1968 and after. But I think most debilitating, from the point of view of building a revolutionary alternative to the communist parties, was the impact that Stalinist ideology had on the left as a whole, including lots of people who, you know, would have said that they're opposed to particularly Russian Stalinism. Okay, so you know, the radical wave of the 60s and 70s, for all the hope that it generated, was not sufficient to overthrow capitalism in even a single country. As the movement finally exhausted itself in the late 70s and into the 80s, the radical left was thrown into a crisis which sent its constituent parts flying in a variety of different directions. Some favoured outright reformism and joined the mainstream social democratic parties, like particularly the Bennites in the UK. You know, those who'd been in the Labour left when it was strong in countries like Australia tended to adapt to the right-wing lurch of the party or else dropped out of politics altogether. Other people trailed off into the various, you know, social movements, which became more and more, you know, self-absorbed and over time institutionalised. Communist parties continued to move to the right, and on the as well, you know, most of the many thousands of people who joined the revolutionary left retreated into you know, their personal lives and away from political action. So that was the main response. There's another reaction to the retreat, which began in the 1980s and has gained wide support over the last decade. His attempts to regroup the different currents of the shrunken left into united organisations. And there's been, you know, many variants of this. In Australia, the SWP, the precursors of the Socialist Alliance, developed a regroupment perspective in the 1980s, embarking on a series of failed projects for unity, with the hardcore Russia Line Stalinist Socialist Party, who were, you know, probably one of the most Stalinist pro-Russia parties in the world, and as well to the abortive attempt to set up the Nuclear Disarmament Party. And these attempts coincided with a broader orientation of the SWP towards establishing relations with a variety of international currents, many of them, you know, quite Stalinist. So SWP-DSP organised conferences have been addressed not only by members of various Stalinist parties, but even spokespeople from supposedly socialist countries like Vietnam, the most recent example of that, I think, being in 2010. Now, most probably on the international left who advocate one form of regroupment or another would strongly reject the idea that the revolutionary left should engage in rapprochement with openly Stalinist organisations. And yet there's been a broad tendency over the last decade to downgrade the importance of major political differences, particularly when they relate to historical questions. Now, I'm not saying in this that, you know, the organisational boundaries should be drawn solely on the basis of the exact characterisation of Stalin's Russia. While the Russian question is still very important, I think there's no principled reason that meaningful unity could not be achieved on the basis of a common hostility to the Stalinist regimes, past and present, without clarifying, you know, their exact nature, deciding whether they're state capitalist or whatever. But I think the question of Stalinism goes well beyond just how you characterise this or that regime. Just as important are questions like the Popular Front, the relationship of the class struggle to the anti-imperialist struggle, the nature of the state, which I have no time to talk about today, the role of the working class and its relationship with other social forces, all of these things, which I think are heavily impacted by the legacy of Stalinism. And I think what's needed above all is to break the historic grip of Stalinism over the left is the reassertion of socialism as a movement based on the working class struggle, not an ideological movement bringing together workers, sections of the middle class, guerrilla movements, national liberation organisations, or leftist sounding governments. And really, you know, the Arab revolutions that we've seen over the past few months pose all of these issues absolutely point blank. They've put mass revolutionary struggle back at the forefront of world politics, threatening, you know, not only Western-backed dictators, but every regime in the region, as we're seeing in Syria at the moment, including you know, many regimes, Libya, Syria, and more, that sections of the Arab and international left have previously either backed or had some illusions in. The Arab revolutions have also begun to raise all the questions of revolutionary strategy and tactics long dismissed as being arcane theoretical disputes. Now, what is the relationship between the democratic and the socialist revolution? What is the role of the state apparatus? What attitude should the working class have to other forces? How far can we trust the middle class leaders thrown up by the struggle? On what basis can workers and socialist parties be formed? A question that is at the centre of the debate in Egypt at the moment. And the truth is, there's not simple answers to any of these questions, and many new questions are going to be posed as the struggle develops in the coming months and years. But I think that overcoming the legacy of Stalinism's distortion of Marxism is going to be absolutely essential if a new socialist left is to be built, capable of rising to the challenges posed by the first great wave of revolution of the 21st century. Thanks.